may suit you. You'll sail direct to any port on board an ocean's crew. Then love your neighbour as yourself, will sing while sailing through the ship canal to Manchester on board our ocean's crew.
A few weeks ago, the port of Manchester was in the news. An accident on the famous Manchester Ship Canal temporarily closed the terminal docks. The incident served to bring home the importance of this unique sea link to both Manchester and the Northwest. Also, in this, the 75th anniversary year of the opening of the Ship Canal, it reminded us of the foresight, perseverance, and independence of our forefathers who promoted the project, overcame immense difficulties, and brought the whole concept to a successful conclusion. This commemorative program traces, through the voices of three old men in their 90s who actually worked on the construction of the canal, and others who have close connections with it, the history, the life, and the times when they brought the sea to Manchester.
You'll see great ships from distant climes and men of every hue lay Earth's vast bounties at your feet and take your goods in lieu. Then trade will flourish all around and peace and plenty too. And every thrifty man you'll see will paddle his own canoe. Then love your neighbour as yourself, will sing while sailing through the ship canal to Manchester on board our ocean's crew.
As you approach, you can see these vessels sailing apparently through the fields, and it does give you a remarkable feeling to know that that vessel has come from the other side of the world and is sailing so close to your door.
Well, it's the most beautiful thing that ever come into Manchester. There'd be no Manchester only for it. But people don't realise what a mighty concern it is. I never dreamt, although I was working on it, I'd see a boat 14,000 tons coming up it.
There's no doubt about it that the Ship Canal was the making of Manchester as a city. Without that magnificent waterway, Manchester would have died in the Industrial Revolution.
There'd all been fields and farms, there'd been no trade. They really did build Manchester by building the Ship Canal.
They brought the sea to Manchester, a far-fetched dream in the minds of men of vision that became a reality 75 years ago.
The Manchester Ship Canal, of course, was made largely in the bed of the River Irwell and the River Mersey, westward from Manchester to Liverpool. But clearly, the two rivers had been used as a navigation, certainly very much so in the 18th century. The Irwell and Mersey Navigation Company was in existence.
It wasn't until the late 1870s and the early 1880s that it was felt that the canal should be made. Due, of course, to the recession of trade in Manchester, due to the high railway charges and Liverpool's high dock charges.
It was quite clear in the second half of the 19th century that Manchester was not only not growing, it was declining. There was considerable decay in the area. It was considered that Manchester had no future. Industry was beginning to leave, and taking with it skilled workers.
And as the people went, so did rates. The ordinary rates which people pay for the existence of a city. And of course, without rates, a city can't exist. In fact, there were well over 18,000 empty houses within the city of Manchester in 1881. To say nothing of the empty warehouses and other factories, etc.
It was that period which promoted the idea of the necessity for a ship canal. Something had to be done. And, of course, the period 1883 to 1885 was the time spent in formulating plans.
And as with everything else, a leader is necessary. And in this case, fortunately, there was one man. Strangely related, he wasn't a Manchester man. He was a northerner. He was a Durham man by the name of Daniel Adamson. But he lived in Manchester and had a business, works at Duckingfield.
Transport costs were far in excess of shipping from Liverpool, and the only way that Daniel Adamson saw it that Manchester, the city that he loved, was going to survive, was to make it into the, as he always, I believe, used to say, the third largest port in England.
And he called a meeting at his house in Didbury to get the feeling of the, well, the various Lord Mayors, the VIPs of all the surrounding districts, not only Manchester, but he brought them for all the areas within the county and some in Yorkshire too. And there were about 86 people, I think, at this meeting, the idea being to see whether they should go ahead with the idea of a canal, which meant, of course, if they were agreeable, seeking powers in Parliament.
Mr. Adamson was in good form, and with a strong Northumbrian burr, reverted to the wonderful success attending the improvement of the Tyne, the Tees and the Clyde, and felt sure the Mersey was amenable to similar treatment with even better results. If the Suez Canal, situated in a barbarous country, and where for 50 miles there was a solid cutting of the depth of 26 feet could be carried out, there ought to be no engineering difficulties to stand in the way as far as the Mersey was concerned. He commended the scheme, believing it would be very advantageous to the constructors and a mighty blessing to Lancashire and Yorkshire.
There were frequent public meetings called to get the voice of the public, whether they were in favour of the canal or whether they were not. I went to the meetings, you know. They allowed a few youngsters in. And of course, we applauded those for it, and we and shouted down these that were against it.
You know, if you're forced to do something to live, you've got to create something. I think it brought into effect that spirit more than ever it would have been.
He was a remarkable man, was Adamson. It was a great pity that he did fall out with the promoters later on, before the canal was finished.
Here's his pedigree. There is Daniel Adamson of the Towers, Didsbury, Withington, son of Daniel Adamson, who was the licensee of the Grey Mare at Shildon in County Durham. And all his predecessors, as you can see, were yeoman farmers, all of Durham. Well, evidently, Daniel Adamson, my great-grandfather, had a leaning to being an engineer, and in due course became chief engineer to George Stephenson of the Stockton and Darlington Railway. And having there learnt his experience of boiler-making, presumably he thought there was some money to be made out of making boilers, and in 1842 he started the engineering works at Duckingfield.
He was a dour, tough man. He wasn't afraid to say what he thought. And on many occasions that got him in bad books with certain people. But he wasn't afraid to speak his mind.
He was a typical, bluff, outspoken, very religious man. He didn't blink, he didn't smoke.
But there was plenty of fire and feeling when he addressed meetings at the town hall, to awaken the imagination of the people as to the benefits and the better life that would follow if they supported the construction of a ship canal. Such was the enthusiastic spirit of the period that the promoters went ahead with their plans. But to prepare a bill and deposit it before Parliament is one thing. To get it passed by a committee of both houses is quite another. Strong opposition to the proposals came not unnaturally from the Mersey Dock Board and Liverpool Corporation, who feared great harm to their trade. The Liverpool Courier put it,
"The question at issue is not whether Parliament will allow Manchester to compete with Liverpool for maritime supremacy, but whether Manchester shall be allowed to utterly destroy this port in futile efforts to make itself a seaport. That Manchester will ever see masts of the great steamships of the Atlantic and the East Indies mingling with its chimney stacks is a picturesque scene never to be realized."
Even Punch contributed a crack or two in its columns.
"Little row in the House of Lords tonight. Manchester Ship Canal down for second reading. Lord Reedsdale doesn't like ship canals.
Never had them in my day," he growls. "If this thing goes on, have England cut up into mincemeat in a few years, make a sort of Holland of this island. Never be able to drive half a mile without coming across a ship in full sail. Have steamers pouring smoke into your front bedroom window and get hit on the head with the main top mizzen boom when you look out to see where smoke coming from. Have no more of them here as long as I am chairman of committee."
For three long and expensive years, the battle of words raged. But despite the jocular and the hostile criticisms that poured down on the promoters, their third bill, with many onerous conditions, finally passed both houses of Parliament and received the royal assent in 1885. A weary but triumphant Adamson returned home.
Rejoicing in Manchester, and not only Manchester, but the surrounding areas, they pretty well went mad. In fact, Adamson's coach, the horses were taken out and he was drawn through the streets by the people. So pleased were the men in the street that the city was going to be brought back to its original status.
I've heard from my old granny of the wonderful reception that he had when he came back to Manchester after his final success in the House of Lords. I've got pictures somewhere of the carriages in procession on that great inaugural return, cheers and all the rest of it, and went on.
In Eccles there was very strong support for the idea of the canal company, and of course when the royal assent was given, there was the famous ox roasting ceremony and procession through the borough of Eccles.
The ox was given as a present. I couldn't tell you whether it was my father who gave it or whether somebody else gave it, but it was a present. In old days, a roasting of an ox was only done on great events, you see.
Now, the special excursions had been run by the railway companies, and people had come in carriages and on foot and by tramcar, and it has been said that there's something like 250,000 people in Eccles, which was little more than a large village at that time.
During the arrangements, Father thought it necessary to get something that they could hold as a souvenir with a great occasion, and he ordered thousands and thousands of these willow pattern plates with all the writing on about the passing of the ship canal bill kind of thing, you see. And they were very popular in all the hotels and inns and public places.
If you were present and wanted a sandwich, you paid a shilling, and with that you got one of the commemorative plates.
And the skin of the animal was made into slippers and sold. And the teeth out of the head of the beast, they put gold bars on them to use them as stipends.
With the celebrations over, came the task of raising £5 million capital and the purchase of the Bridgewater Canal, all within a 2-year time limit.
Everybody bought shares who could buy shares. Not for what they could get out of it, but they thought they should support it. It was something that was going to be vital for the country. When you're born in a place, you have a kind of a sense of ownership of all these kind of things, and you make yourself feel that you're a part of it, you know. And I do believe the people at that time were a great part of the Manchester Canal. I think everybody felt it was their canal, and they must support it and help it, and for it to help them in the future.
There was strong opposition to the idea of constructing a ship canal. There were always those people who said that it would be a complete failure, and equally strongly on the other side, the people who believed in its success. So much so that the promoters of the idea of the canal used every means, press, pamphleteering, meetings, and even small area committees, which literally went from door to door asking people to buy shares, just a few shillings here, a few shillings there, until, of course, the thing was established.
Old Daniel Adamson said to his workpeople, "Will you help us to subscribe to the funds?" So they paid in those days, apparently, a penny a day for hot water for the tea. And in addition, they all agreed, and there were people, there were about 600 or 700 of them, to pay a penny a day each towards the ship canal funds. And it was always said, what with K waiter and say waiter, they went out in pay packet.
Money was indeed hard to come by. For whilst the working class favoured the canal, the wealthy and influential few were harder to convince. Disagreements arose amongst the directors, and Daniel Adamson resigned as chairman in favour of Lord Egerton of Tatton. Under his leadership, the money was finally raised, and the digging of the sea link to Manchester began in earnest.
Ye working men of Manchester, it much depends on you. Come put your shoulders to the wheel and paddle your own canoe. Hooray then for the ship canal, 3 cheers, me boys, for you. Luke up your rusting implements, there's lots of work in view. Then love your neighbour as yourself, we'll sing while sailing through the ship canal to Manchester on board our ocean screw.
I must have been about, I should say, between 9 and 10, because I remember them fetching a silver barrow, and there were 4 gentlemen, and they cut something out of the ground and put it in this barrow. That was when they first cut the sod, as far as I remember. It started in 1887 and it finished in 1893. It took 6 years to build it.
Well, I was born in 1879, and I just want to give you my little career as regards ship canal. I started when I was 12, but I started on the false pretenses. They said I hadn't to start without I was 14, and I run home and told my old mother that I could have a job in the morning if I was 14. She says, "Well, you shall have your brother's certificate." He was 2 years older than me. So I started on the false pretenses. And the wages then was tuppence farthing an hour, 10 and 4 pence for a week of 56 hours.
I was born there in 1876. That's my home. I worked on the canal from I was 13 at various jobs, wagon greeting, point turning, nippering for gangs and all that. I went down there and asked him, his name was Tom Wiltshire, for a job. "Yes," he said, "I'll give you a job, lad." He said, "You can go into the cripple yard there," he said, "and greet them wagons after they've finished them." I said, "All right." So I went there.
I was fatting wagons all the time, I'd say for 18 months or 2 years. We had a box of wagon grease. I always remember when I started, the boss told me, says, go to the joiner's shop and tell him you want a fat box. Well, they made a square box, I'd say about 9 inches square with a handle on it, and we had to go to a barrel of grease, fill that box up, and then we had what they call a fat stick, a bit of wood improvised out so we could dive in, and we had to crawl underneath. There was no axle boxes outside like there are on the wagons today. There was all, you had to get underneath and plaster it in under the pedestals. And you crawling about in slutch or anything, that was Patton Wagon.
There was every county in England represented on the canal. Every county in Scotland. Every county in Ireland. But there were very few Welshmen. I don't remember only one Welshman on the job, and a Cornishman. Cornish Jimmy.
Oh, we had hundreds of Irishmen on the canal. Yes. Hard workers and all. Oh, they had to work or else get out. Oh, with plenty of Irishmen from one end to the other. They wasn't like our people. There was, no, honestly speaking, there was more sedate. You never hear them swear once in the blue moon. No. Our bookers can't open them. Oh, no, there was good, hard-working lads, there's no doubt about it. Well, my navvy ganger, I was fighting for this gang. He died, I think he had about 7 Irishmen out of his 10 in the gang, because they'd work harder than the Englishmen. They're all robust, you know, and strong as bloody lions.
Lots of people have the impression that all the work was done with pick, spade and barrow. Well, that is not true, because even in those days they had what was then modern plant. There were the German Lübecker land dredger. There was also a French model. But the bulk of the work was carried out, of course, by the labour. There were well over 16,000 men and boys employed on digging the canal.
There was a mighty lot done by hand, what they call graft. Barrow roads and these chaps, these from Lincoln, there used to be perhaps a gang of them, about 13 or 14 of them. They used to take a job piecework, you know. And they used to do it all by hand till eventually, anywhere where they could get one of those excavators, well, they'd have one. But there was places where they couldn't get them. But it was wonderful. Yes, pick and shovel, and it was what they call good money, but not much of it. Yes. Yes.
Now, as regards the young fillers, they were different prices. They were piecework. Some they got 1 8 pence a wagon. Some they got 1 10 pence. But if it was bad stuff and wet, they got a 0.5 crown. There was 4 gangs doing that at the backy. Charlie Prattley, Lady Killing Ginger. There was one gang there, they were Lincolnshire chaps and Cambridge and Norfolk. They didn't have a ganger. They were a leading man. They were great, big, powerful fellas. And these bill boys always loaded up a 9-gallon barrel of beer and paid for it in their turn. They say, "Hey, boys, come on, we'll have a whole of ale." And they used to drink it out of a cow's horn with the bottom in. That's what they had. They were men. I say they were men. They were strong as elephants. And there was one man who worked there. He was a tall fellow with a sandy beard. He used to call him Salvation Harry. He was a Salvation man. He was the best spade man ever I saw in my life, either before or since. He was automation.
Well, there was men that always could say they could put that much on a barrow, you know. They used to brag. There was Lincolnshire men that it was impossible to wheel it away without the handle breaking. And they gave them a nickname. They used to always call them Stoughtons. Stoughtons, I don't know why, but there was a big, hefty lot of men, more like farm labourers and all that. I can picture them now, like in them days. Roll up of a morning, 6 o'clock, strip off, and perhaps some of them had hung fire a little bit, like about pulling enough off, and the gang of man would say to him, "Now then, my lad, what are you going to do? You're going to let the sun burn that jacket off? You know, take it off without a murmur, you know." That's as near slavery as we can go back to, you know. They had to do what they were told. They do what they like today, don't they? Yes. Yes.
They drank heavily. They swore heavily. And they lived rough. This song to the they were men. You haven't got them now. We had to work. It's never been done since. Mustn't have done me any harm, else I wouldn't have been older. I'm nearly 92. A few more months, I'll be 92.
Oh, they'd never let the old navvy in 1,000 years. No, the old navvy would do 2 days while they was thinking of one. No, and they never stopped. They used to be what we call blinding Jane. He said, never stop. The old navvy gang would never bother them.
Well, hard work, bitter beer, that's why I'm living today. Because I never ate much food. And yet I'm as strong as a lion now. Can't get a job. I'll be 90 in a couple of months. Twitter's a fiddler, as I say, can't get a job. That's bitter beer for you. Yes, well, it's true.
Tough they may have been, but this didn't stop a great many being injured, or worse.
Unfortunately, like other schemes, there was loss of life on the construction.
With a very high accident rate. This was anticipated by the chief engineer. That is why he was instrumental in getting Mr. Robert Jones as the surgeon in charge of the accident and indeed medical service for the construction years.
Oh, yes. There were a lot of people killed, a lot of people injured, and it maimed for life. There was a man cut in two, a little bit farther up there.
I think there were 139 people killed during the just over 6 years that it was being constructed.
Yes, yes, and of course it was an organised accident service. Strategically, the placing of the three base hospitals, of the dressing stations, the first aid stations, and of the use of the railway, which ran, the overland railway, as they called it, which ran along the canal, which could bring a seriously injured man with very little delay to a base hospital. So that it did not depend on chance. It really was an organized scheme, an organized accident service.
And at one time, there was quite a lot of talk in Runcorn about an accident that happened in Inchcutting.
I think a train fell into the Great Cut, and there were indescribable scenes. They had to get them out with the use of steam cranes, and there would be a lot of amputations, and a good many of those injured men would not live, would not survive.
There's an old gentleman, name of Mr. Antrobus, and he remembers my father's accident. He used to tell me about it. how men pull their shirts off and all manner of clothing to help to tie him up and get him away to Latchford Hospital. And he said he was a very brave man.
The injured man would be picked up by the first aid people, put on a stretcher and into a truck on the little railway, and dispatched to the nearest base hospital, where there was a medical officer acting under Robert Jones, who became pretty skillful in combating shock and giving the immediate first aid until Robert Jones arrived to carry out the major surgical treatment. He was described as a sun man, irradiated. I've seen him go around hospitals with men with shattered limbs who really gone through it. A few words, a smile, a little hint. The man, all eyes, looking at this man as if he were a god.
Floods and severe winters also delayed the work and increased the cost. Loans from the Manchester City Council enabled the project to continue, and at long last, they let the water in.
This house here was flooded. Me look to that window sill there. They let it in on a Saturday night. All that land over the other side of the canal, right away, up to Runcorn Highway, was flooded. All up that lane at the other side there, past that farmhouse. They lifted the sluices that high at Latchford, that when they come to try to get them down, the volume of water under the gates wouldn't let them. The cattle were standing up to their bellies in water.
The ship canal was unofficially opened for through traffic to Manchester on the 1st of January, 1894.
I was at Latchford Locks when it was opened. Just before Christmas, they arrived a yacht in the canal. It was a schooner rigged, and it had an auxiliary engine in as well. I know where I stood when I saw it go past. And the crew were dressed in sailor's clothes. It belonged to Platt, the textile machinery manufacturers at Oldham. Now, exactly at 12 o'clock on New Year's Day, this yacht blew its siren and proceeded up the canal in the direction of Manchester.
The very first day I missed the opening, but we looked out anxiously to see the different sorts of ships that began to navigate the ship canal. We could hardly swallow that boats would come so lofty that the funnel would have to be top part of it taken down.
Since then I've thought many a time, it's wonderful. I wouldn't have missed it, no. And I just long, I'd love just to have another do if it was possible.
Her Majesty Queen Victoria agreed to perform the official opening ceremony. 37 years had passed since her last visit to Manchester, when she described the Mancunians as a very intelligent but painfully unhealthy-looking population. She came on May the 21st, 1894, to declare open the man-made seaway that was to begin a new era for Manchester, make the city into one of Britain's major ports, and contribute immeasurably to the growth and prosperity of the Northwest. And so the seal was set on a story which embraces all the elements of the great restlessness of that age when they brought the sea to Manchester.
Thousands of people you could have walked on the heads, Mary.
Oh, yes, crowds of people. Because my father held me up, you know, to see her. I always remember that. And I can see Queen Victoria going down Piccadilly now.
A real letdown. She was drab, in black, and she was just like any other old woman, you know, in very rusty black. And I could have wept. I think I did. With disappointment. I expected her to have a crown on her head.
She was a little old lady. And I was still with that Queen Victoria. I was astonished because she looked what I thought as a queen, you know. And she was nodding like that. Well, I found out that she wasn't actually nodding to the people. She was in a rocking chair. And it made it for her convenience, I was told that. And it kept doing that, you see, bowing to each side of the place. She had a bonnet on and ribbons here, the old style, you know. And all the soldiers coming by and bands playing, I don't know what. I shall never forget that as long as I live. It was a most imposing affair.
I now have great pleasure in declaring the Manchester Ship Canal open.
They Brought the Sea to Manchester, a documentary compiled, edited and introduced by Brian Vaughton. The three old men who recalled how they worked on the construction of the canal were Charlie Williams of Fallowfield, John Dobson of Moore, and Charles Chambers of Heptonstall. Other speakers included Sir Henry Platt, Edgar Lee, Roderick Parkin, Frank Molyneux, George Taylor, Richard Gough, Charlie Hughes, Percy Reed, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Pryor, and Mrs. Green. The singer was Harry Boardman, accompanied by Leslie Boardman. The program was produced in our Manchester studios by Stanley Williamson.